Welcome to another episode of Let Go and Lead, where we discuss the new realities of leadership with pioneers, provocateurs, and passionate leadership champions. Today, I'm joined by Marshall Goldsmith, the New York Times number one best-selling author, who's written or edited more than 50 books, which have gone on to sell more than 3 million copies. Marshall's also an executive educator and a sought-after leadership coach for many of the world's top executives. In this episode, we discuss Marshall's new book, The Earned Life, which helps us with how to live our own lives, not someone else's version of them. The key to living the earned life unbound by regret requires our commitment to a habit of learning and connecting to something greater than the isolated achievements of our personal ambition. We also discuss several key lessons from Marshall's extensive life experiences and years of personal and professional coaching. In the end, Marshall's wisdom and insights were so powerful that we decided to break up the interview into two episodes. I hope you enjoyed this first episode as much as I did. So get comfortable and get ready to let go and lead. Well, Marshall, thank you so much for joining us. I'm so excited. I mean, as you know, I've been following you for many, many years and am so excited to have this opportunity to spend time with you.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You just have such an amazing career, and in so many ways, as a coach, as a speaker, as a best-selling author. But can you just tell us a little bit about your career journey?
Well, I was getting a PhD at UCLA with no real idea as to what I was doing. I met some great people in the field of organizational behavior. I was fortunate enough to meet Dr. Paul Hersey, who was the highest paid guy in the world in our field at the time. He, with Ken Blanchard, invented situational leadership. And I just followed him around and, you know, and carried the bags and literally served the coffee and tried to learn what he did. And one day he said, "Can you do what I do?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, I'll pay you $1,000 for a day if you can do this." And I said, "Well, I'm making $15,000 a year. I'll give it a shot."
Oh, wow.
And that's how I got into leadership development and then coaching. I was with a CEO and, he said, "I got this kid working for me, young, smart, dedicated, hardworking jerk." He said, "It'd be worth a fortune to me if this kid would change his behavior." So I heard the term fortune again. I said, "I like fortunes. I'll try it." He said, I doubt it. I said, "Maybe I can help him." He said, and then I came up with an idea. I said, "I'll work with him for a year. If he gets better, pay me. If he don't get better, all free." You know what he said? Sold.
How did you approach it?
I do the same thing still. I give people confidential feedback. Uh-huh. So they find out what they're doing well, what they need to do better. They pick important behavior to improve. In this case, this kid and the CEO had to agree these are the right people and the right behaviors. We identify the stakeholders. I build in a very, very solid follow-up process where they talk to people and follow up over and over again, and we measure improvement. And you've seen the research on this. And anybody listening would like to see a copy of it, my email is marshall@marshallgoldsmith.com. I'll send you a copy of it. Leadership as a Contact Sport is the name of it. And 86,000 people. This stuff pretty much always works.
That's really amazing. And in that, I know you talk a lot about how people can really achieve positive outcomes, lasting change. You talk a lot about behavior change. What are some of the tips that you have for people on that regard?
Well, I mean, the first thing is my most famous book is called What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And a key point of that book is my clients are incredibly successful people. There are challenges that come with success. And one of them is what I call the superstition trap. I behave this way. I am successful. Therefore, I must be successful because I behave this way. Wrong. Everyone I meet is incredibly successful because they do things right and many things wrong. And nobody's so good that we have nothing on the in spite of column. So what I tell people is really to look in the mirror and say, what's going well because of and what's going well in spite of? And typically the people I coach, their biggest challenges are try to prove themselves right too much, win too much. The reality is they've been brought up as winners. And it's hard for winners just not to constantly win all the time. And I have to teach people, as you move up to the CEO ranks, quit winning. It's not about you being a winner. You're already a winner. It's about them being a winner.
I remember when I read the book, the biggest insight for me was around adding too much value. That's always stuck with me. That probably, like, that was, book was probably 15 years ago or something. And I think about that all the time.
Well, you know, that one hits so many people. It's a classic disease of smart people. What happens? You're my boss. I'm young, smart, enthusiastic. I come to you with an idea. And if you're not careful, you say, well, that's a nice idea. Why don't you add this to it? The problem is the quality of the idea may go up 5%. My commitment to execute just went down 50%. It's no longer my idea, boss. It's now your idea. It's really hard for smart people not to constantly add value. And one of my coaching clients retired several years ago. His name is J.P. Garnier. He was CEO of GlaxoSmithKline. I said, what'd you learn about leadership as a CEO of GlaxoSmithKline? He said, I learned a hard lesson. My suggestions become orders. Now, I said, if they're smart, they're orders. And if they're stupid, they're orders. If I want them to be orders, they're orders. If I don't, they're orders anyway. My suggestions become orders. So I said, what'd you learn from me? Before I speak, breathe. I just asked myself one question. Is it worth it? And he said, about half the time, back to your point, what did you decide? Am I right? Maybe. Is it worth it? No.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic advice. And I have to keep reminding myself. What are some of the other most common barriers that you see for success?
Well, you know, the stuff I teach is incredibly easy to understand and difficult to do. First, it takes a lot of courage to look in the mirror. The theory behind this is quite easy. The practice is hard. I teach something called the daily question process, and half the people that start doing this quit in 2 weeks. It's just hard to do. It's hard to have the courage to look in the mirror. It takes humility. It takes humility to stand up and say, I can do better. One of my great coaching clients is Hubert Joly, CEO of Best Buy, turned the company around. Spectacular guy. He stands up. My name is Hubert Joly. I have a coach. I'm trying to improve. Please help me. I need your help to turn this company around. Not, I'm Hubert Joly, I'm the boss, and you're not, and do what I tell you. So it takes a lot of humility, and then it takes discipline. Because what I teach involves day-to-day work. And you don't get better because you listen to a motivational speech or read a book. You get better because you work every day, try to get better. And it's like the tennis player. They got to practice all the time. They don't quit practicing when they get to the top. You got to keep working. So it takes a lot of courage, a lot of humility, and a lot of discipline. Very hard to do this stuff.
I know in the Earned Life, you talk a lot about discipline and the building blocks of discipline. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, part of it is just an interesting one is compliance. That sounds simple, right? Compliance. Something like 30% of the people that have life-threatening illnesses don't take the medicine. Why? Well, I didn't get around to it. And you know, part of these building blocks are just having the will, not the willpower, but put yourself in a situation where you get structure and direction. Let me give you an example I've talked about. So if everyone listening learns nothing but me, what I'm going to say next, they'll get better at almost anything. I'm going to teach you something that takes 3 minutes a day, costs nothing, help you get better at almost anything. People are skeptical. 3 minutes a day, costs nothing, help me get better at anything. Ridiculous. Sounds too good to be true. Half the people quit in 2 weeks. It's hard. I have someone call me on the phone every day to make sure I do this. So I said, why do you have someone call you on the phone every day? Don't you know the theory about how to change? I wrote the theory. My name is Marshall Goldsmith. I got ranked number one executive coach and leadership thinker in the world. I have someone call me on the phone every day to help me. Why? I am too cowardly to do any of this stuff by myself. I'm too undisciplined to do any of this stuff by myself. I need help. I need help. It's okay. We all need help. Once we get over that macho stuff. So how's it work? I'm going to give everybody just 6 questions to illustrate how difficult this is. If you do nothing but answer these 6 questions every day, you're going to have a better life. Question 1, did I do my best today to set clear goals on a 1 to 10 scale? 10 is high, 1 is low. Did I do my best to make progress toward achieving my goals? Did I do my best to be happy? Did I do my best to find meaning? Did I do my best to build positive relationships? And did I do my best to be fully engaged? Just ask yourself those 6 questions every day and fill out the questionnaire. 1 to 10 scale every day. End of the week, you get a report card.
How does, just to give other people a sense of how this goes, how does the best leadership coach in the world do every day at a scale of 1 to 10?
Some of them I'm actually pretty good. On the happy score, I score way high. I'm very good at happy. I'm very good at declaring victory in life. I do, one of my daily questions is, did you declare victory in life today? On that one, I get a 10 every day. Every day I declare victory in life. Others, not nearly so good. Let me just talk about some of my other questions. I frequently fail. Over COVID, I was expert at walking. Well, you know, I didn't have so much of a schedule. Now I find it's much harder to get in those 10,000 steps. My push-ups, my sit-ups, spotty result. Weight, pretty good on the weight dimension, Writing, pretty good. I got somehow cranked out 51 books. So pretty good at putting time and effort into the writing. But every day, one of my questions is, did I do my best, for example, to be patient? Not always so good. Some days pretty good. Some days not always. How about, let me give you one of the hard ones for me. How many times yesterday did you try to prove you were right when it wasn't worth it? Oh, I don't see too many zeros for me on that one. You know, kind of hard for that old professor not to be right all the time. So, you know, if you do this every day, I can send anybody all my questions if you like them. Just send me an email and I'll send you all my. Now, the point is, though, other people shouldn't copy my questions. Just write your own questions. That's the most important thing.
I'm sure you'll hear from many people, though, who'd love to get yours.
Well, go ahead. Send me an email. I'll send you all my questions, an article about this. But I can tell you, anybody that tells me this is easy has never done it.
Yeah.
It's easy if you've never done it. Try it. It's not easy. It's embarrassing to look in the mirror every day. It's embarrassing. It's humbling.
So how did you pick your coach or the person that calls you every day, your accountability buddy?
Well, I've been doing this for 25 years, so I have different people. Right now, my friend Mark Thompson does this because we talk all the time anyway. But I've done it with friends before. I paid people before. For years, I just paid someone to do it.
What were the qualities you looked for in that person?
Not much. I mean, all I have to do is call up on the phone. And they don't have to do much of anything.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Just all they need somebody to do is just remind me to do this. Daniel Kahneman's got a great quote. What I see is all there is. If you don't keep something in front of you, it just goes away. Now, let me give you an example. Twyla Tharp is the world's greatest choreographer. She's had the same personal trainer 27 years. Now, why? The trainer doesn't teach her anything new. The trainer just makes sure she does what she knows she's supposed to do. If she would do it by herself, she wouldn't hire the trainer. Now, that's why she looks great at her advanced years. She looks great because somebody kicks her butt every day.
You know, you mentioned you score very highly on being happy. And yes, you do. I mean, whenever I think of you, that's what I think of just what a joyful, happy person you are. And this morning, as I was looking forward to this interview, it was like, I was just, my heart soared thinking about just being with someone so happy. How did you foster that, or where does that come from?
A lot of it, my new book, The Earned Life, is basically a Buddhist philosophy book. So let me share my Buddhist philosophy. I'm not a religious Buddhist. I'm a philosophical Buddhist. So people of any religion could apply stuff in that book. My Buddhist philosophy is this. Buddha was brought up, at least the metaphorical Buddha, I'm not sure there was a real Buddha, but maybe the metaphorical Buddha was brought up very rich and father had a king, was a king. And his father believed he would be happy if he had more. So he kept trying to give him more and more and more. And he lived in a bubble protected from life. And then one day as a young man, he was able to sneak outside. And you know what he learned? What's that? People get sick. Ugh, not so good. Sneaks out again. You get old. Number three, you die. Old, sick, die. So this is not so great. All this more stuff doesn't do much about old, sick, and die. More doesn't work. He went out in the woods and tried to be happy with less. Starved himself. You know what he learned? Didn't work either. Finally, one night he realized something. You can never be happy with more. You can never be happy with less. There's only one thing you can ever be happy with, what you have. There's only one place you can ever be happy, here. There's only one time you can ever be happy, now. This is it. Where is Nirvana? Nirvana is listening to an old bald guy talk on his podcast right now. Here it is. It's not out there someplace. It's right here. And if you're not going to find it here, you're not going to find it someplace else.
And do you see happiness and joy as the same thing?
Well, that's a very good question. Let me give you my definitions. Now, and also my old mentor, Dr. Paul Hersey, taught me this. Only use operational definitions. So when I use a definition, I'm not saying it's a good definition or a bad definition or the right definition. Many people define things in different ways, which is perfectly fine. So I'm going to give you my definitions of a couple of terms. Happiness to me is joy in the process of what you're doing. In other words, I love what I'm doing. Meaning is the results of what I'm doing are important to me. So happiness, when I use that term, I'm talking about process, meaning I'm talking about the results matter to me. I feel they're important. So I differentiate these two terms in that way.
And how would you define joy?
I never did. I don't know. You can define it however you wish.
Have you always had like the sense of humor that you have and just...
My father had a great sense of humor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so yeah, I've always had a good sense of humor. And yeah, like I said, life is short. So I've always, always just tried to enjoy myself.
You think about leaders and really them trying to be their very best selves. Do you have a definition for the best self of a leader, or is it circumstantial?
Well, I think to a degree it is circumstantial, but let me describe some of the qualities of the great leaders I've met. And the great leaders I've met, I'll mention two. Alan Mulally was the CEO of Ford, and the stock went from $1.01 to 1840, went up 1,837% while he was the CEO, and he had a 97% approval rating from every employee in a union company. Unheard of for a CEO, right?
Right.
Just a wonderful person. A great friend of mine. We're working on a book together. I just love him. Well, you know, Alan taught me many lessons, and he said for the great individual achiever, it's about me. For the great leader, it's about them. Another great leader I met is Frances Hesselbein, former CEO of the Girl Scouts. And she and Alan, to me, have almost identical personalities. On one hand, they're both incredibly positive people. I've never seen either one of them be down, depressed, poor me, victim, none of that stuff. On the other hand, if they need to be tough, they can be tough. So Alan has a good phrase, you know, heart of gold, backbone of titanium. And Francis is the same way. You know, they're both wonderful human beings, but they got a mission. And you cross the line, you've made a mistake. And they'll deal with it. So they're both really sweet, nice, kind, loving people. And they're also strong people. And they're not pushovers. You don't turn around the Girl Scouts or the Ford Motor Company just by being nice. You know, you got to make hard decisions sometime. And they are both perfectly capable of making a hard decision on one hand and being kind and loving on the other.
And how common is that among the leaders that you coach?
Well, number one, very few of the leaders I coach are common, period. If you read the first six pages of my book, I wouldn't say any of those people are very common. I mean, look who they are. They're all pretty exceptional people. I would say that it's not common among human beings.
Right. I guess I was just, the question I was trying to ask is, do they have that in common with one another?
The best ones do.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't put everyone I coach's name on the book. I also coached a guy who was ranked the worst CEO in the United States. Worked with a guy for a year and he didn't get better. He was the worst one before he met me, and after me, he was still worst. Right? He wasn't a bad person. He just wasn't suited to be a CEO. He didn't care for people. He didn't like people, basically, and really didn't want to be in that job. Many human service leaders are terrible CEOs. You know why? They love humanity. They just can't stand human beings.
As you work with leaders and you're trying to help them change their behavior, what do you think are some of the greatest levers in terms of someone changing their behavior?
Well, the first thing is, I don't work with anybody that doesn't care. So one of the great questions I get is, how do I motivate people to change? I don't motivate anyone to do anything. I am not a motivational speaker. I don't give pep talks. I only work with people that care. And what I tell them is, if you don't care, I don't care. I don't waste my time with people who don't care. That's another great lesson I learned from Alan Mulally. I said, only work with great people who care. If they don't care, don't waste your time. So first thing is, they have to want to change. And if they want to change, and they're given a fair chance by the company, which some people, by the way, are not, if they are given a fair chance and they do want to change and their issue is behavioral, the odds on my failure are close to zero.
And when you say people who care, is that what you're referring to, that they want to change?
They have to try. Not just care, they have to work. They have to talk to people, they have to follow up, they have to do all this stuff. Arnold Schwarzenegger made a great quote, "Nobody got muscles by watching me lift the weights." Well, I don't lift the weights. You know, they have to lift the weights. They lift the weights, they're going to get stronger. I can help them and coach them on how to lift the weights, but I'm not lifting the weights for them. They got to do the work. And the ones that do the work get better, and the ones that don't. Now, the good news, I've done research from thousands of people on my process who've been to my classes. I've actually got feedback from tens of thousands of people who've been to my class. You want this article? It's called Leadership as a Contact Sport. Send me an email. I'll send you this one. 86,000 people. You know what it shows pretty conclusively? People that go to my class, take it seriously, talk to people, follow up and do the work, get better, a lot better. And the ones that do nothing, guess what? Now, I've got good news. They don't get worse. They just stay the same.
I read somewhere, I can't remember where, where you talked about it's easier to change behavior than perception.
That's right.
Talk a little bit about that.
If you have a Roman numeral watch or clock, it's a great exercise. Ask someone who owns one, what does the 4 look like? Invariably, they'll say it's an IV. And about 90% of the time, it's not an IV, it's 4 eyes. I've done this with people who own the same watch 40 years and never saw it. Never saw it. Well, why? Because we've been programmed to believe something. And once we're programmed to believe something about a person in the same way, it's hard to change. Now, let me talk about why follow-up is so important and why it's hard to change perceptions. The best research principle in psychology is called cognitive dissonance theory. We all see people in a manner that's consistent with our previous stereotype. If I have a stereotype that you're a bad listener, I'm going to look for a bad listener in whatever you do and say until I find it. It's hard to change these stereotypes, these perceptions. Here's why follow-up is so important. Let us assume case study A, that I'm a leader and you're the leader and I'm your colleague. And you get feedback. You don't talk to me. You don't follow up. You don't do anything. But you quit making bad comments. You used to make bad comments. Now you don't. You say, well, it's good. I changed. 7 months later, you say, stupid idiots and finance idiot bean counters. How do we get anything done in this company? It's run by a bunch of accountants. I hear you. My reaction is she's never changed. That one comment will trigger my previous perception. She's never changed. Case study 2, you do what I teach and you talk to me. You say, I got this feedback. I want to be a better team player, not make bad comments, give me ideas. I don't believe you're going to change. I give you a few ideas. I'm thinking it was a waste of time, temporary religious experience. They send them to these bozo courses. They come back. They talk to us. This will never last. What happens, though, 2 months later when you say, it's been 2 months. I said I want to be a great team player, not make bad comments, give me ideas for the next two. I started thinking, you've done a good job. 4 months. Good job. 6 months. You know, to be honest, I didn't think you'd change. You worked very hard. Thank you. 7 months. Idiots in finance. I say, you shouldn't have said that. You worked 7 months without doing that. You say, you're right. I'm going to apologize. Situation A, did behavior change? Yes. Did perception change? No. Situation B, did behavior change? Yes. Did perception change? Yes. In leadership, it doesn't matter what we think we said. All that matters is what they hear. It is hard to change perception. That's what I've been paid for over all these years, not just changing behavior, which is much easier, changing perception, which is much harder.
This is interesting because I'm just thinking about a quote I've often heard of what you focus on manifests itself, which is related to what you're talking about, because it seems to me that you're actually coaching people to help them learn how to get others to focus on their effort, not just the result of the effort.
Well, you know, that's quite true. And that quote is true to a point. Now, I don't want to overpromise on that quote. There is one of the most ridiculous books ever written is called The Secret. Have you read this book?
No, I haven't. I guess it's a good thing.
This book sold 7 million copies. And the premise of the book is, if I envision it, it will happen. That's it. That's the secret. If I envision it, it will happen. And they have these case studies. Mary envisioned becoming a movie star, and she is. And, you know, Jim envisioned winning the basketball tournament, and he did. And Harry envisioned his cancer would go away, and it did. Their stories are all true. The problem is they didn't interview the 1,000 waitresses in Hollywood who all envisioned being movie stars, and they're not. They didn't envision all the basketball players that lost, and they didn't interview all the dead people. All they interviewed is the winners. In mathematics, this is called the survivor bias. So that's one of the problems with just telling stories about people who are successful. The premise is they did this, they are successful. Therefore, when you do this, you will also be successful. Maybe not. Now, envisioning things improves our odds on success. It's a good idea. But never assume just because I envision it, I'm going to be a success.
No, that makes total sense. And, you know, we're talking a lot about success. How do you define success?
Well, The Earned Life talks a lot about that. Let's assume that you have a middle to upper class level of income, and everyone listening to this podcast is making enough money. Now, they might not, they believe if I had more money, I'd be happier. Statistically, not really. Once you hit to a middle kind of level of income, money is not going to change your happiness very much. Let's assume, number two, you have good relationships with people you love. And by the way, the book is not a book about money, and the book's not a book about getting a date. And let's assume that you're healthy, and the book isn't about that. There's only three things that matter. In the book, I talk about our aspirations. Now, what is our aspiration? Well, in The Earned Life, our aspiration is that higher purpose. You need some sense of, why am I here? Why am I doing this stuff? I'm working hard for what? It doesn't have to be religious, but it has to be some higher sense of purpose. The second element is our ambitions, and our ambitions are what we achieve. Now, while our ambitions have a set timeline, they are achieved by a certain point and a finish line. Our aspirations don't have a finish point or a timeline. And finally, our actions, that's our immediate day-to-day activities. Now, if you want to have a great life, alignment is a key word. If your actions are aligned with your ambitions, are aligned with your aspirations, you're probably having a great life. My daughter Kelly and I did some research on this. And what we found out is when you're working, what you're trying to achieve, if those achievements are important to you and meaningful, and simultaneously you enjoy the process of doing it, you won the game of life. If you're enjoying the process but not achieving something meaningful, your life is empty. Like, why am I talking to you? I could be playing bad golf with old men at the country club while eating chicken salad sandwiches and discussing gallbladder surgery. Now, that might be pleasant for a while, but I think after a while I get bored doing that. There's no punchline there. There's no meaning, at least for me. And so it doesn't work. On the other hand, if you're doing things that are meaningful but produce no happiness, you're a victim or a martyr. That's not so great either. So the key is, can I simultaneously connect my level of achievement with my level of aspiration and enjoy the process of life? If I can do that, I just won. Now, let's talk about our listeners. And we discussed this before the call. Who is listening? Well, if you look at the history of the world, most people are stuck in that action phase, our day-to-day activities. Our ancestors were poor people. They didn't have any money. They lived from day to day. You did what was in front of you. And most human beings today, they're pretty much stuck in that activity action phase. They're just living from day to day lives, trying to get enjoyment, playing the video game, doing whatever they have to do to get by. That's most human beings. Some people, maybe college professors, priests, live up in their heads. They're living in that aspiration phase. They might overweight aspiration. In the same way most people overweight the action phase, some people overweight the aspiration phase. They're just lost in their head. They dream a lot, but they don't do anything. And they may or may not enjoy the process of life. The people listening to you and me right now typically don't have either one of those problems. These people are lost in achievement. They're lost in those ambitions and their day-to-day achievements. In many ways, become addicted to achievement. Now, what does that mean? One of the things I teach in the book is never place your value as a human being based on the results of what you're trying to achieve. Never place your value as a human based on results. That is a fool's game. We don't think about this. We always think achieve is good. If your value as a human being is based on achievement, you got a lot of problems. one of the people, one reason is we don't have control over what we achieve. I didn't invent COVID. You didn't invent COVID. If my value as a human being is based on some of this stuff, what happens after COVID? I didn't get to be better, worse person. And what happens if you do achieve? One of the names of the people on the front of the book is Albert Bourla. Albert's the CEO of Pfizer. So I talked to Albert a few months ago. I said, Albert, how's it going? He said, oh, good. How was last year? Came up with this vaccine thing. Very good. Very good. I said, fantastic. I got one myself. Thank you. Very, very good. Yeah, and a CEO of the year, and you know, employee engagement through the roof, and company pride is high, and profits, and stock price. I said, fantastic. Albert, what's your problem? I have a huge problem. Next year. Do you think anybody that bought that stock cares what he did last year? Nope. If Albert's value as a human being is he always has to beat next year, beat last year, kiss it away. Kiss it goodbye. He's never going to do it again. Michael Phelps, 25 gold medals. What do you think about doing after winning the 25th gold medal? Killing himself. Can't beat it. You see, if your only value is achievement, you're never satisfied. The Buddhist term is the hungry ghost. You're always eating, but you're never going to be full. Safi Bacall is one of the most brilliant people I ever met. Now, he is part of a group that inspired my book, The Earned Life. The book was inspired by 60 people. My friend Mark Wright and I spent 600 hours over COVID. Every weekend, we would spend 6 hours with these people and listen to them talk about their lives. And they were in rotating groups of 10. One of the people, like head of the Rockefeller Foundation, and you know, the basketball star and the football star and the Broadway star, all kinds of amazing people. And one of them is this guy, Safi, a brilliant guy, PhD with physics in Stanford. He wrote a book called Loon Shots, a great book, New York Times bestseller. He has made tens of millions of dollars, started companies, consulted to presidents, blah, blah, blah. He said, I finally learned something in these groups. It was from Curtis Martin. Curtis, a great football player, number 5 rusher in NFL history, said, Curtis is always happy. He said, I learned something. I used to believe that my happiness was dependent upon my achievement. He said, I finally realized happiness and achievement are independent variables. Be happy to be happy and achieve to achieve, but never believe achievement will make you happy. And I said, Safi, this is good. You know why? You already have a PhD in physics from Stanford. You've already written a New York Times bestselling book. You've made tens of millions of dollars, consulted to presidents. Now, exactly, if that is not enough to make you happy, if you haven't achieved enough, well, what does it take? He's already a 99.999 on achievement. You think really going to a 99.99999 is going to make any difference? No. He said, you're right. You're right. Well, it's a great way to look at life, achieve to achieve. And be, the great Western disease is I'll be happy when I get the money status, BMW, condominium, when I achieve my goal, I will be happy when. We never get the when. By the way, there is one type of book that always has the same ending, and they lived happily ever after. And that book is called a fairy tale. That's a fairy tale. That's not life. Life is every time I take a breath, I start over. Every day I start over. There's no when. There's no place I'm going to go to where I achieve eternal happiness and everything is fine forever. That's not real. We always start over. And the key is learning to find peace and happiness now.
This is a good place to wrap up our discussion around finding peace and happiness. Marshall's perspectives, though often based around his experiences in business coaching, are very applicable to personal development as well. Key learnings from our interview include life lessons on common barriers to achieving success, which start with having the humility and courage to look in the mirror and say, I can do better. Another important lesson is around changing behaviors and perceptions. People not only have to want to change, but have to work at changing. They have to actively seek feedback and demonstrate follow-up to enhance perceptions around their behavior. Marshall also shared 3 key elements in defining success: Number one is our aspiration, or having a higher sense of purpose. Aspirations don't have a finish point or a timeline. The second is our ambitions, which are quite simply what we actually achieve. And finally, our actions, which are simply our immediate day-to-day activities. As Marshall said, if your actions are aligned with your ambitions and those are aligned with your aspirations, then you're probably having a great life. In episode 2 of this interview, we discussed the evolving requirements around leadership in the new working world and, of course, what leaders need to let go of. I hope you'll join us for that episode too. Thank you for joining us today.